After reporting on China for more than a decade and hearing constantly from a wide range of its citizens, Denny McMahon has come to a startling conclusion. The narrative of China as an ascendant superpower is fraught with misconceptions. Discovering brand new factories that have been shut down, finding empty and relatively new abandoned cities, and looking under the cover of a shadow banking system, McMahon methodically pieces together the alarming truth that China's perceived economic growth, he believes, is a myth built on a staggering mountain of debt. And when that debt bubble bursts, he says the whole world could suffer. Denny McMahon spent more than a decade in China as a journalist covering the Chinese economy and financial systems for The Wall Street Journal and the Dow Jones News Service. Again, the name of the new book is China's Great Wall of Debt, Shadow Banks, Ghost Cities, Massive Loans, and the End of the Chinese Miracle. And we welcome Denny McMahon to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good night, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Very nice to have you. Obviously, you are a journalist who has worked in China, covering the Chinese economy and the financial system for the Wall Street Journal, as well as the Dow Jones News Service. What brought you to want to look at this in particular, this wall of debt?
Well, what I was covering while I was in China was always the financial system. When I first started out as a journalist in Shanghai, it was covering China's financial markets and specifically the currency. And when I moved over to the Wall Street Journal, I was covering China's banking system. But in the past, the way that the banking system had been covered, it was a lot more about the liberalization of the banking system and the opening up of opportunities to foreign investors in the financial system. And it was the reform of this kind of very, what had traditionally been a very sclerotic state-owned banking system. But when I took over, I kind of saw that things were starting to change. In fact, I think it was perhaps the first or the second story I wrote for the Wall Street Journal was about how banks had started hiding their loans off balance sheet using some institutions that would later become the pillars of China's shadow banking system. So a dynamic that wasn't that unlike what had happened in the United States during the subprime crisis. And so over the next few years, it was an area that I watched very closely, watching the debt accumulate aggressively and just looking at the mechanisms that allowed that to happen.
So in looking at those mechanisms, what was the need in the sense of why did these shadow banks, what was the necessity for these shadow banks to erupt?
Well, it's hard to say that there's an actual necessity, but there is sort of hardwired into sort of China's political system this need to generate fast growth at all costs. And so what we saw, to kind of talk you through what actually happened, in 2008 when the global financial crisis hit, China responded by having a massive stimulus program. But it was very different to the ones that happened elsewhere in the world. So, you know, in the United States, the stimulus was led by the central, by the federal government. But in China, pretty much Beijing told the banks, okay, you're in charge of the stimulus. We want you to lend as much as possible, and you're going to get the economy going again. And so they let them do that for about a year. And then at the end of the year, they were like, okay, well, you know, things are going well. Economy's back on track. Stop lending as much. And so formally, the banks stopped doing it. But, you know, behind the scenes, what they were doing is coordinating with the shadow banks. And so the reasons this were happening is partly because in the course of that year, so many new projects had started and they still needed credit in order to be finished. But the other dynamic at play here is that throughout sort of every level of government, whether it be counties or cities or provinces or even state-owned enterprises, the measure of success is growth. It's about growing your firm. It's about stimulating your economy, your local economy at sort of all costs. And so this is the dynamic. You kind of had these local level government officials who were always demanding more and more credit. And so the financial system responded. Even though Beijing was nominally telling the banks, okay, you've got to act more prudently, the financial system as a whole was responding to this sort of demand from local government officials who wanted to sort of drive growth at all costs.
In talking about this book, you have said that this basically has come out of the the quirky stories that you have written when it comes to the Chinese economy, and that even though you perhaps did not realize it at the time, the stories that you veered toward were the weird and the quirky. And when you look at the system overall, it is just that, quirky.
That's right. I mean, you kind of assume that China is a major successful economy, sort of broadly works the same ways as, as the United States does or as Europe does. But it really has its own internal logic, which has a lot to do with, the way that the country is managed. So, for example, one of the stories that I had, I spent a number of years following was the phenomenon of ghost cities in China. So a ghost city kind of takes the traditional idea of a ghost town and completely turns it on its head. So, California and Colorado are dotted with ghost towns that sprung up during, various gold rushes. And then when the gold ran out, the towns emptied of people, and now we have ghost towns. Whereas in China, what happened is these ghost cities, firstly, are an order of magnitude bigger. They are proper cities. And they were not so much, they didn't so much lose their population, but they were built, and then the population they were built for never materialized. I used to visit a particular ghost city up in Liaoning province, which is up in China's sort of frigid northeast. And to be honest, it could have been one of the most nicest cities that I'd ever visited in China. It was beautifully landscaped. They'd spent money building an ornamental lake with these ornamental government buildings and high-rise office towers along the side of the lake. And there were canals weaving their way through the various housing developments that were built in the city. But the thing is, there was a fraction of people living there. And ultimately, this place hadn't been built for the people. It had been built in the interests of economic development. Because mayors, as I was saying before, they're kind of, their success is determined by their ability to drive growth. And the easiest way to stimulate, the thing is, these guys are only mayor for maybe, their terms are for 5 years. And generally speaking, they don't even make the 5 years. After 3 or 4 years, they're moved on to another role. So when you're trying to make your mark in such a very short period of time, and particularly when you're trying to stimulate growth, you don't have a lot of options open to you. And the easiest option is to borrow money and build something, because you get the benefits of that boost to growth immediately. But the actual cost of having to deal with the debt, well, that falls to somebody else once you've moved on.
In looking at the economy, and the name of the book, of course, is Great Wall of Debt. So let us talk for a moment about that debt. That is the problem at the core of their economy, correct?
Yep, that's right. But the best way to think about it is not the absolute amount of debt, because generally speaking, China's levels of debt relative to the size of its economy is broadly in line with that of the United States. Maybe a little bit more, but kind of broadly in line. The issue is more the pace at which that debt has accumulated. So other countries that have piled on this much debt this quickly have almost invariably experienced some sort of financial crisis, such as in the United States prior to the subprime crisis. Or, Spain prior to the Eurozone crisis accumulated debt at this pace. Japan prior to the lost decade of the 1990s. Thailand prior to the Asian financial crisis. So we're kind of at a point now where it really becomes genuinely risky if China keeps on accumulating debt the way it does. And so when we talk about debt, though, it's kind of important to understand exactly who's doing the borrowing. Because it's easy to think that, it's not like what the United States experienced. This is not households borrowing to buy housing. And it's not like the Greek situation, that the debt isn't the responsibility of the central government. The organizations that have been doing the borrowing are companies, mainly state-owned companies and local governments. And the things that they've been using the money for are building things like, public works, new housing, and factories. And usually on the face of it, you think they're pretty positive things. I mean, those sorts of things typically contribute to the value of an economy. But the borrowing has been so excessive and the investment and the construction so excessive that you've ended up with a huge amount of waste in all of those areas. And so you've got China is capable of building, for example, manufacturing, way more steel than it could ever possibly hope to use. And the same goes for aluminium and ships and excavators and paper and plate glass. And the list goes on and on. And you have the same problems with housing. Housing has been built in parts of the country in such volumes that it will never be needed. And local governments are the same sort of thing. They've invested massively in public works that are underutilized, and they're going to be paying off the debt that they needed to build it for a very long time to come.
The name of the book is China's Great Wall of Debt. Denny McMahon is our guest. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. So with that said, do we even know the full extent and of the effects of that debt?
Not yet. And one of the reasons for that is because China's very, very good at papering over the problems. And one of the ways that happens is that we can't always trust the data that's published. So, for example, the non-performing loan level, so at China's banks, that is sort of the volume of debt that has gone bad as held by the financial system. The official level for that is actually really quite healthy. It's a little bit higher than the United States, about the same level as Germany. But the thing is, we can't really trust those numbers. In fact, the central government in Beijing doesn't trust those numbers. Just a couple of months ago, the banking regulator put out a list explaining all the different ways that the banks hide their bad loans. And so at this point, given that you can actually see the waste, like physically see the waste as you drive around the country, the numbers, as we're told by the banking system, don't add up at all. And on top of that, when push does come to shove, the Chinese government is actually very, very good at papering over the problems in the financial system and kicking the can down the road. And so the chances are we're not going to experience the sort of financial crisis that we've become so accustomed to in sort of, market economies around the world, because the government in China is always willing to spend more money just to sort of tide things over and to, make sure that things really don't start fracturing in a very destructive way.
So how does this dovetail with the U.S. economy, what we have been through in the past decade, and our own debt?
When you say our own debt, do you mean the U.S. Treasury, sort of the government borrowing, or
yes, the debt okay. that this country continues to amass?
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, well, this has always been a long-term problem, both for the U.S. and for China. So China owns a massive amount of foreign exchange reserves. So this is U.S. dollars that it's accumulated over the years, and it has to invest it in somewhere. And so most of it. It's invested in U.S. treasuries. And the U.S. has certainly been nervous about that in recent years because people kind of worry, well, what will happen if the Chinese decide to dump all those dollars, those U.S. treasuries one day? But the problem is China's not really in a position to do that, to kind of, dump them or use them as a weapon in fit of pique. China has been trying to become less reliant on the U.S. dollar for a very long time. When it comes to these reserve holdings, it's tried to diversify time and time again. It now holds more gold than it used to. It's invested in everything from warehouses in Australia to office buildings in London as a way to sort of somewhere else to sort of park this money. But the problem is, it holds so much in sort of foreign exchange, in foreign reserves, and there's just no other place that can absorb that money other than U.S. treasuries. And the other issue here is that it really needs to keep a big chunk of that money in a very liquid asset. Once again, nothing's as liquid as U.S. treasuries. So we saw a couple of years ago that China's foreign exchange reserves fell by about $1 trillion in the space of a year. Now, when it needs to be able to convert currency on that sort of scale in such a short period of time, it really needs to maintain those reserves in a very liquid asset. And that's why it remains dependent on U.S. treasuries. For the time being, at least, it really can't afford to sort of give them up.
So when so many in the U.S. look to China with envy as to their place in the world and their economic situation, what are they/we missing?
Yeah, I think at the moment, China is very much shrouded in this aura of inevitability, that sort of China's ascent to become the world's biggest economy is preordained, or that it's inevitable it'll become the great power of Asia, or even, you know, it's inevitable that one day it will challenge the United States for the role of global power. But the thing is, at this moment, China's almost facing a perfect storm of challenges to its economy. So, I mean, clearly the book focuses in large part on the debt problem and how it needs to change the way the economy works. But on top of that, there's a whole lot of other challenges it's facing as well at the moment. So we typically think of China's great competitive advantage as being the fact that it can manufacture things cheaply. And traditionally, that was the case, but certainly no longer. To give you an example, I met a Chinese entrepreneur a few years ago, and his story was fairly common. He'd started off working for a state-owned firm, and then he went out on his own in 2001 when China joined the World Trade Organization, and he started his own factory making yarn, taking cotton and spinning it into yarn. Anyway, he's had a tremendously successful business. But when I met him in 2013, I met him because he was planning a massive expansion of his business, but he wasn't planning it in China. He was actually boxing up all his machines and shipping them to South Carolina. And what he told me at the time is that this business just didn't have a future in China because it was just too difficult to survive. And the reasons were China was just too expensive for him. The cost of land in the US for him to buy his factory was so much cheaper than anywhere where he was operating in China. The second issue was energy. A big cost for him was electricity to power all his machines. And he reckons he was saving about two-thirds of his electricity bill if he moved to the United States. Other companies, not this guy in particular, but other companies are finding that the cost of complying with environmental rules are going up. Traditionally, China didn't really worry about that. But these days, the government really cares about how bad the air quality is. But perhaps the big issue is the cost of labor. Now, traditionally, journalists and I have written about how China's kind of had this, you know, endless supply of labor moving from the countryside to work in factories in the city. Well, as it turns out, it wasn't endless, and it has come to an end. I mean, you don't have this massive wave of migration happening anymore. The migration flows are slowing very acutely. And at the same time, you've got to remember that China's working age population is actually shrinking. This is the direct fallout of the one-child policy. China is aging perhaps as quickly, if not faster, than any other country in the world. So since 2012, they've had less a declining working age population. That's going to fall by tens of millions over the next decade, which will mean that wages go up and China will be a much less competitive place in the world to do business. So this is kind of all the various economic challenges that China's facing at the moment. And yet at the same time, you so often hear that there is this, you know, from people saying, look, you know, China's government has been in this position before. It has experienced so many major economic challenges, and yet every time it needs to reform, it sort of steps up to the plate and it manages to take the tough decisions and to get things done. And yet in my 10 years as a journalist in China, that's not what I saw. What I saw is that the success of that decade was first and foremost based on the government's ability to paper over the problems and to kick the can down the road. Now, that's not to say there weren't efforts at top-down reform, but most of those efforts were then stonewalled by lower levels of government and state-owned firms that either pushed back against the reform, or they implemented them partially, or they might comply with the letter of the law whilst circumventing the spirit. And I think that's going back to your original question. That's what we don't see. From the outside, we see this incredibly strong and vibrant economy, but up close, it is far more dysfunctional.
My final question to you is one that I find interesting, and I just don't know how it fits into the larger picture. But when it comes to the long haul, and we look at the future of both China as well as the United States, where are we, do you think, in the effects of the decisions being made right now by President Trump here in the United States and President Xi in China?
You know, that is an incredibly difficult question. I think if we take the U.S. side first, clearly the U.S. needs to do something about the trade relationship. It is incredibly unbalanced. China manufactures an incredible amount of goods and ships them to the U.S., not just because it's incredibly or intrinsically competitive, but because of a range of factors, including subsidies and various types of protection that Chinese manufacturers get at home. So the U.S. needs to be able to do something about it. I think what we're going to see over the next few years, or you know, for years to come, is kind of the process of working out how to change that is going to be a process of trial and error. So you take something like the steel tariffs. No doubt the steel tariffs will help the U.S. steel industry, but it doesn't hurt China in any particular way. Now, China exports a massive amount of steel. It exports more steel than the United States even produces. But the thing is, very little of that comes to the United States because this has been a problem for years, and so the U.S. has been pushing back for years. Most of that steel goes to other countries, and then those other countries, their own domestic steelmakers, they then export their steel to the United States. So these tariffs aren't going to have a big impact on China. But we are going to see over time, sort of fine-tuning and experimentation until we do actually get to see changing of the trade balance and a changing of the trade relationship. Meanwhile, from the Chinese side, perhaps the biggest change we're seeing at the moment in China is a political change, and that is the consolidation of power in the hands of the party, and specifically in the hands of President Xi Jinping, who looks as though he's going to be in charge for a long time to come. Now, in some ways, that might be a positive for China being able to pursue economic reform, because if given the problem of the last decade has been the ability of lower levels of government to stonewall reform, if he's in charge for if he is the man in charge and there for the long term, he might be able to break through that and clean up the excess. At the same time, there's nothing to suggest that this sort of more centralized autocratic political regime is going to naturally lend itself to the sort of reform that needs to happen to raise the competitiveness and raise the efficiency of the Chinese economy. So it's difficult to say categorically what's going to happen on that front either.
The name of the book is China's Great Wall of Debt, Shadow Banks, Ghost Cities, Massive Loans, and the End of the Chinese Miracle. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Denny McMahon is the author. Denny, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
No worries, Joe. It's great talking to you.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is China's Great Wall of Debt. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.